It's wonderful to think that somewhere in interstellar space, that sound is moving along on a golden record. It was launched many, many, many years ago, and it's part of Carl Sagan's Hello, whoever's out there. This is a little bit about what Earth is all like. It was not only Beethoven, it also included Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good. Any excuse we have to play a little Chuck Berry, we'll take it. We'll hear him a little later. Plus, there were a lot of greetings. We'll find out more about what was sent out there and also talk about if it makes any sense to be sending messages into interstellar space right now in 2016. Our guest has written a fascinating book, and he's an incredibly interesting person. Ben Miller is with us. His book is The Aliens Are Coming, The Extraordinary Science Behind Our Search for Life in the Universe. He is a quantum physicist who was getting his PhD and then decided, well, you know, I think I'd rather be a comic. So he became, of course, he became a comedian and did all these TV shows on BBC. He's very, very well known in Britain, probably not as much here because we don't get BBC. He's also a Shakespearean actor. He's done Hamlet. He has done all kinds of films, and he is our guest. He's written other books as well. He is a quantum physicist, and he wrote a series of documentaries and wrote another book, which is titled It's Not Rocket Science. He's the host of the TV show of the same name. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as we look at, you know, a lot of very interesting issues. Is it time to send another message? How is it that we came to be? And are there things that we've learned about Earth that will help us in finding life elsewhere? Will it help us? And I wondered about this, too, ever since we did a show on dolphins some time ago. If we can, why can't we learn to communicate with dolphins? And if we learn how to do that, will it help us if there are signals that are sent here that might be hard for us to decipher? Is it a similar kind of scientific quest to learn why it is that dolphins speak and what kind of language they are communicating? Well, all of that is what we're talking about this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ben. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show and Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ben. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello. How wonderful to be on the show. It's very exciting to get the chance to talk about some of this stuff. It feels very current, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It always seems current. And not only did you, you're an amazing guy, you also finished this 100-kilometer bicycle ride this week, didn't you?
I did something absurd, yes. I did a charity bike ride yesterday.
Yesterday?
Actually.
Woo.
Yeah, well, yes, I cycled 100 kilometers in that my route took the shape of a moustache, and I cycled 100 kilometres around the south of England, and I cycled on solo on a tandem.
Oh, my gosh.
So the idea, I don't know if you have the charity Movember, don't you? Have you heard of that charity, Movember?
Movember.
Yes. Yeah, so
yeah, facial hair, Movember, yes.
Yeah, Movember, facial
yes.
hair. So, yes, it started in Australia, I believe, and is now spread around the globe. And the idea was originally you grow a moustache to, and you accept donations, you know, and you grow a moustache throughout the month
right.
of November, and then you collect on your donations at the end of the month and donate the money to men's charities.
Mm-hmm.
Movember is a charity all about men's health issues, really. Because we lose the men in our lives too young. Men die sooner than women for largely preventable reasons. So the idea was to sort of, is now to raise general awareness of men's health. So the idea was to do a bike ride, because one of the things that men tend to neglect in later life is exercise. So this is a long way round of saying. I did a charity bike ride, yeah, 100 kilometers yesterday, and I'm extremely saddle sore.
Yeah, I'll bet. And you're not going to be an astronaut either, huh?
No, I'm not. This is the furthest I will get. Yeah, my sortie into the wilds of Surrey, I'm afraid, is as far as my ambition to be an astronaut is ever going to take me. I would have loved... I really grew up on the NASA expeditions to the moon. They were such an important part of my childhood, and I think for school children, now grown adults like me, and for anybody who witnessed those incredible moon landings, the question of what there is out there in space is very... It feels like something we increasingly have hints towards. So this is it, what's so interesting about this subject is that it really, to give it the brief sweep, up to the time of the moon landings, when we landed on the moon, even the astronauts that went to the moon, there was not. Not a complete certainty that they wouldn't see some kind of alien being along the way.
Yes, right, yeah.
And Buzz Aldrin, I believe, reported some sort of extraordinary experience that he felt he'd had while in transit to the moon. Of course, when the moon landings took place, it very quickly became apparent that the moon was an extremely barren environment, and that there seemed to be no way there could be life. And you mentioned Voyager, the early 1970s spacecraft that is still on its transit through our own galaxy. It's now, left the part of our galaxy we call the heliopause, and it's on its way heading for the very edge of our galaxy, which is a distance of it's going to take some 30 or 40,000 years to reach the edge of the very edge of our own solar system. I'm so sorry. Mm. When Voyager, flew past the giant planets, it became apparent very quickly that they too didn't seem to be the kind of place that life could exist. So for a long time, we had this idea that the solar system was a very sterile place, and of course, our recent discoveries have completely changed that.
Yes, they have recently. Plus our discoveries, as you remind us in the book, of things that can live in very extreme temperatures here on Earth. So our definition of what can live and where it can live has changed.
Has completely changed, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, of course, it was the Brock, the microbiologist, who discovered the first extremophiles, these bacterial organisms, single-celled organisms, living in these gorgeous blooms, these colours, these beautiful, rainbow-coloured blooms of life around the hot pools in Yellowstone Park, which he soon realised these pools were just far too hot to possibly harbour life. There was no way that anything living, it was believed, could survive at those kind of temperatures. And we've since found life in all kinds of environments where we had no idea that it could possibly exist. In the middle of nuclear reactors, at the very top of the atmosphere, right down in the rocks. Bacteria that live in rocks. As far down as we can dig, we find bacteria. So suddenly, life seems a lot more tenacious and a lot more inventive than we'd ever had reason to believe.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, are you disappointed that, by all accounts, we haven't heard from anybody who was able to get a hold of the golden record?
Well, this is an interesting question, because everybody says we've never heard anything back from space, don't they? That we've never had a message. But the interesting truth is we've never had a confirmed message. We do believe we may have actually had one. This was, again, in the early 70s. It was on a radio telescope in Ohio, and a radio astronomer who had actually had his program cancelled, his research program cancelled, called Jerry Ehrman, and was doing research on the Big Ear. And he recorded something that's become known as the WOW signal, because when he was looking he was looking to see what the telescope had picked up through the night. There was an incredibly loud, very narrow-band frequency. You know, typically, things that are messages, that messages would be broadcast over a very narrow band of frequencies. Other objects in the solar system that give out radiation broadcast that radiation of a very wide range of frequencies. This is a very, very unusual-looking signal, and he wrote on the piece of paper in capital letters. It's wonderful. You can look at it. Give it a Google, because it's
a
fantastic thing to see.
Yes.
He's written, "Wow!" exclamation mark, and a sort of right next to this extraordinary signal. Now, everybody else has since... there's been a lot of research done on the "Wow!" signal, and it's never been confirmed. No one has ever picked up a similar signal from the same source. But it remains not quite the case to say that we've never picked anything up.
Hmm. Isn't it something, and you ask what we would be sending now, we're going to play little tidbits during the course of our conversation of what Carl Sagan and others thought was appropriate to send about who we are back in the 70s. You asked the question at one point in the book, if we are to send a message now and you have doubts as to whether or not we should, what should it be? Should we send one at all?
Well, yes. I mean, there is a theory, you know, if you're out in the jungle at night...
I haven't done that.
There's a theory that if you're out in the jungle at night, the best thing is to keep quiet. And we don't know, do we? We don't know where we are. We don't know. We might be in a jungle. It might be, of course, that this life on Earth is the only kind of life, the only life of its kind, in other words, intelligent, complex life, anywhere in the universe. That might be true.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't know, but there are those. In which case, you'd say, you know, why not broadcast? Say whatever you like. You know, shout it from the rooftops. You know, we're here, and we'd like to hear from you. But there are others. There are others, and the astronomer Stephen Hawking is one of them, who would say it's probably best not to send a signal because first contact, as far as we've experienced it here on Earth, doesn't always turn out so well for the less technologically advanced civilization. And he would quote the example of the Native Americans and the frontiersmen, or the example of the Christian missionaries in Africa, and point out that it doesn't necessarily work out well for the culture without the technology.
Mm.
So it's an interesting question, and it's one that really is quite deep. It really makes you think, because it makes you think about what is it that we want to say anyway.
Right.
You know, why do we seek this contact anyway? Why do we believe that any other intelligence, technologically advanced civilization would seek our company?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting. You raised the question of dolphins.
Oh, I love dolphins.
I love dolphins.
Me too.
I think there's no question now. I mean, in the 60s, of course, it was, you know, the idea of dolphin research was very current and very popular, and there was this very exciting idea that perhaps dolphins could be taught not only to communicate with signs, but also to learn human language. And there was a research program that was famously run in conjunction with SETI, the NASA, at the time, NASA-funded search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which investigated the language capacity of dolphins. Now, unfortunately, some of the experimental methods that we used were not really, they weren't really accepted by the wider scientific community, and dolphin research fell into disrepute. Well, it's recently been revived by a number of very exciting researchers, and there's some fascinating research about dolphins. It turns out if you take dolphin clicks and whistles and you subject it to actually a very simple mathematical analysis, you can show that the frequency with which certain whistles and clicks are used by dolphins mimics the frequency with which we in human language use certain words and phrases.
That's fascinating.
So in other words, when we're talking to one another now, it's in your interest for what I'm saying to be as clear as possible and for you to gain as much information as possible with the least amount of effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm to communicate with you, I will reuse certain words and phrases much more than any other words and phrases. And there's a natural efficiency to that, so that, say, for example, the most used word in anything that I've been saying this evening so far will be used 10 times more frequently than the 10th most used word.
Mm-hmm.
And that simple mathematical relationship holds not only for all human languages that have so far been analyzed, which is quite interesting, don't you think?
Yes.
But it also works for dolphin whistles as well. And there's a wonderful research group. One of the members, Lawrence Doyle, I spoke to when I was researching the book, who have taken this same research, and they're now proposing, you know, we should analyze all animal speech, because it seems that humpback whales certainly seem to have a certain complexity of speech. Dolphin speech, you know, quite interesting, you know, because there's a very tried and tested form of a mathematical way of analyzing the complexity of language. And when you apply those rules to dolphin language, it turns out that it's not like human language. You can get a huge sample. You know, you have to record dolphin clicks and whistles. And with the biggest data set they could find, when they analyzed it to see how complex dolphin language was, the complexity kept revealing itself. So in other words, it may be that dolphin language is as complex as human language, or maybe even more complex.
Yeah. Isn't it something that it's so hard for us? Here we have gone to the moon and we're sending things into interstellar space, but we can't crack the code of dolphin language. And it makes me think of what you say earlier in your book. If somebody got that golden disc, who knows what kind of language they have, if they have ears, if they have eyes, how they might be able to crack all the codes that are on that disc that we sent out into space,
yes,
right?
Because culture is the key, isn't it? Culture is the key that can crack the code. You know, if we share a culture, you know, if we share the same reference points, there's a chance that we can find enough common ground to be able to understand one another's languages. You know, a really good example of this that I discovered when I was writing the book is, of course, the Egyptian hieroglyphs,
mm-hmm.
where we sort of, by the time of Napoleon, before Napoleon became emperor, obviously, when he was still a military commander, he led an expedition to Egypt and recovered many, many Egyptian artifacts. My dog's barking.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's fine.
It's my dog barking. She doesn't like the sound of Napoleon.
What kind of dog do you have?
I have a Wheaton Terrier.
Oh, no. So do I.
You don't?
Yes,
you don't
I
have
do.
A Wheaton Terrier.
I do. He's 13 years old.
Oh, gorgeous. My Ruby is only two.
Oh.
So she'll bark at anything she thinks is outside.
Yeah.
You know the Wheaton, the best watchdog in the world, the worst guard dog.
Yes, they are. Exactly. Yeah, they're great dogs. They're hard to handle, but they're
yeah, great. They're very hard to train.
I know. Oh, that's something, you have one. So where were you?
I'm sorry.
I can talk about
the
dogs forever, too.
Well, there we are. It's still about communication, isn't it? It's very interesting. So, again, you know, we share enough culture with dogs, for example, to know what the dog is barking at, to know, to be able to understand a different species or a different a completely different form of communication. We need common ground. You know, we need some kind of key. And the example, the great example was the in the case of the Napoleon. You know, when Napoleon led his expedition to Egypt and took with him two dozen of the finest scholars of the age, and brought back all this incredible wealth of hieroglyphs. So suddenly, whereas there had just been one or two hieroglyphs, most of which had been collected by the ancient Romans and brought to Europe, suddenly they had this glut of information, but they couldn't translate it because they couldn't find a key. They couldn't find some common point of reference. And eventually, this wonderful thing, the Rosetta Stone, was stumbled across, this very, very dull text written in three different languages, one of which was ancient Greek and one of which was the hieroglyphs, which finally enabled the European scholars, after a good further 20 years of work, by the way. I'm just going to let her out. 1 second.
Okay.
Let's try again.
We'll just call her Murphy. That's my dog's name. It can be male or female. Hi, honey. Hi, Murphy. Oh, I hope Murphy's not listening at home.
Literally gone to kill something in the garden. So, you know, 20 years later, managed to translate it. And this thing, the Rosetta Stone, has become a metaphor, really, for any translation between two languages. And the big question, when we broadcast our messages out into space, if we decide that indeed is something we should be doing, is how we provide a Rosetta Stone.
Mm-hmm.
How we know that the alien intelligence that is picking up our broadcast knows it's even a signal. How they know to decode the information that's in it. I mean,
right.
It's a very, very difficult, it's a tremendously difficult question to answer.
Yeah. Well, if one of them would like to contact us, you can decode or begin the decoding process of what they may be saying to us. We would welcome such a phone call. We are going to, during the course, because Scotty and I had fun with this as we were reading the book, we were looking at the message that's the most famous that we have sent out. We have sent a message, NASA did, I believe, sent the Beatles across the universe to Polaris, to the North Star, some few years ago. But the Voyager Golden records are those phonograph records that were included aboard Voyager spacecraft launched in 1977. And it's really interesting what people then put on this, their diversity of life and culture on Earth. And Carl Sagan, the brilliant man who put this all together, said the spacecraft will be encountered in the record plate only if there are advanced spacefaring civilizations in interstellar space. The launching of this bottle into the cosmic ocean says something very hopeful about life on this planet. So it's seen as a time capsule. And now it's way out there. It's in interstellar space, if we can even imagine what that is. This is the, well, let me give you the phone number, 800-486-8655. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. If you have another way of communicating, we hope we can figure out what your signal is, and we're happy to hear from you. Here's a clip of Secretary General of the United States Nations, rather, Kurt Waldheim, offering his greetings on the Voyager Golden Records back in the 70s, says that we Earthlings know that we're only a small part of this grand universe. And, well, you can hear what he has to say.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
All right, let's go to phone calls. This hour, we're talking about the aliens are coming, the extraordinary science behind our search for life in the universe. Ben Miller is our guest. Ben is a trained quantum physicist, and he's also an actor and a comedian. And we're going to phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. Doug is calling in from Reedsburg. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi.
I was going to ask, what terms are we using to define life in the universe? Because, I mean, if we're trying to look for something that's humanoid-like, that would, I think, be significantly harder than just anything that happens to be alive, because I think there's those, they're called water bears, I forget what their real name is, that travel all over the universe.
That's absolutely right, yes. I mean, yes, tardigrades, water bears. The question is most certainly what type of life are we looking for? You're absolutely right, because not only might there be kinds of life that we don't recognize, that's simply so unlike us that we wouldn't know it if it was right under our noses, but in order to be able to communicate with it, you're absolutely right, it has to be a very small subset of living things. It has to be things that are reasonably, as you say, you know, humanoid or enough like humans that they wish to communicate, that they communicate with language, that they maybe live on a terrestrial planet, that they are biological, and none of these things are of course guaranteed. And if whether life is widespread or not, organisms like that would be a very small subset of all possible organisms. So just by being human, yeah, we narrow our odds of being able to communicate with anything else enormously.
You don't believe, although we've got, I have to ask you about some of these stories because I'm sure you've heard some incredible tales, so let's indulge in a bit of storytelling.
Yeah.
We haven't found UFO stories that seem entirely credible at this point, Ben?
No, there's not. The UFO stories that we have, fabulous though they are, have not really stood up to scrutiny, unfortunately. I mean, and the more you delve into it, I mean, one of the most, I mean, the famous wave of UFO sightings in 1947, you know, which was the real beginning of the term flying saucer is very easy. It's very interesting, sorry, you know, in this pilot. A pilot called Kenneth Arnold was flying in Washington State. He was flying on a sort of commercial route and flew past Mount Rainier in Washington and thought that he saw a fleet of craft, reported it when he got to Chehalis, which is, I believe, the airport he'd set off from. And the news went out on the wire and misquoted him. He said that the craft were shaped like a pie plate with the back cut out of it. So if you can imagine, they are like a kind of, they were almost a sort of V shape.
Mm-hmm.
But that they moved like a saucer skimming on the water. So he's describing the movement, and that got misinterpreted as them being saucer-shaped.
Oh.
And immediately there was a wave of sightings of flying saucers. And one of the things, one of the reasons we have science, really, is that humans aren't that reliable. We're not that reliable. We live in this wonderful mixture of story and reality and imagination and fact. And we're all very comfortable with, we're all quite very comfortable and very fluid with moving between these different sort of these different means of communication, moving from story to fact to imagination. Of course, what can happen is that we are therefore highly suggestible, and it's really interesting that the when you start particularly that wave, the 1947 wave, is a very sort of interesting example, really, where everybody starts seeing something because they have heard a report, but the report itself was incorrect.
Right.
It's a shame.
It's a shame. I know.
I would love it to be true. And of course, there's no scientific reason why it shouldn't be true.
Right. Well, maybe it will happen to you. You may not be an astronaut, but you
maybe
might
it will.
Be visited.
Maybe they will come and visit. Maybe they have visited already. There's no evidence that they have, but there's no scientific reason why they shouldn't have. Do you see what I mean? It's the kind
yes.
of...
Thanks, Doug, for your call. Bob in La Crosse. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Hey, this is a really interesting subject because what it speaks to is sort of the nexus of the best of humanity and the worst of humanity. At the one point, it's very intellectually stimulating and it sparks our creativity and our imagination. And it speaks to our desire to forge forth and find new things. On the other hand, contemplate the humble housefly. I want to make an analogy.
Okay.
The humble housefly goes out and looks for food in a rather erratic way. And if one were to interpret it in a way, you could say that the humble housefly is out there exploring its universe and forging forth into the wilderness where no fly has ever gone before to find a humble meal. But the problem is, some human comes along and swats that fly without even noticing it, maybe, but purely without malice or without thinking of it. And I'm afraid... I'm really, really frightened that by sending this stuff out there, at worst, it is a malicious thing, and at best, that it's probably just some huge thing or some very, very tiny thing that we can't see. We don't have any sense of what the scale of life in the universe is. We have no idea. It might be imperceptibly small and yet incredibly powerful. So I just feel like if we ever do find the aliens, it ain't going to be a spaceship that takes us up and has sex with us. It's going to be something that crushes us before we even know it happened.
Ben.
I love your analogy, by the way. I think that's just the best analogy I've heard, really, for human life in the universe. Because, of course, we would like to imagine, wouldn't we, when we're in the company of the housefly, that we are the higher intelligence existing on the higher plane. And as you say, we have no interest whatsoever in communicating or communing with or preserving the housefly. We have no interest at all in what we consider to be a lower form of life. But of course, what we have in common with the housefly is that we are biological, that our bodies are made of cells, that we share an almost identical biochemistry, that the building blocks, if you like, of our bodies are pretty much identical, bar some obviously fairly significant genetic variation, but chemically pretty much identical to those of the housefly. But as a technological species, we can see the way it's going. We are currently in the process of trying to invent a new type of robotic species. We're trying to invent and in the process of creating artificial intelligence, which at some point we all believe will supersede us. Deep Blue has already beaten Gary Kasparov at chess about 2 decades ago. Mm-hmm. we're rapidly approaching a stage where the most intelligent, what would we call them, not organisms, but the most intelligent entities on our own planet may no longer be humans. And the further out we look, the less likely it seems that life would be biological. And that might give you even less comfort.
Right.
Because you're not just a housefly that might get swatted by a...
Right.
by a person, but you're in the belly or the jaws of some enormous robotic artificial intelligence.
What happens to us then, do you think?
Bacteria still thrive, don't they? I mean, if probably the most successful organisms on the planet are the bacteria. So they've been here since the very beginnings. We think they may have even been some of the very first life forms on the planet. So I think, you know, with luck, we'll survive a while before our extinction. But we'll either be succeeded by other biological and possibly robotic species. Mm.
Thank you so much for your call. Earl is next.
Really great analogy, Bob.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Earl in Medford. Hello, Earl.
Hello. I want to speak wholly in favor of this, of sending out where we are and who we are, because I think whoever's out there, they'll have a lot more in their minds than dealing with us or dealing with any harm. So it comes up again and again that we're afraid of something, but I think there's just a great opportunity out there, and just to communicate someday.
I would completely agree with you. I mean, I think there's good and bad out there. I mean, if you know, to take a wild guess, and it's no more than a wild guess, I'd imagine there's all sorts of good stuff and bad stuff out there if there are indeed living intelligent technological species. We have already been broadcasting the signals that we send out have been few and far between in terms of deliberate signals, such as there have been signals such as the Arecibo signal, the Mir signal, which the Russians sent to Venus in the early 1960s. These signals have been few and far between, but this radio show is currently on its way.
Where is it going?
It's going
through the universe.
And radio shows have been heading out into the universe ever since its inception at the very beginning of the 20th century. So probably the strongest signals we could date from the middle of the last century. So, you know, we've got a huge spreading envelope some 60 light years in radius out from our own planet, which is certain evidence that we are here and broadcasting. The messages, sadly, have not all been as thoughtful and considerate as this program.
No, they probably haven't. Tell me what we need to. You write about, and I don't understand what this is, the Drake equation and what it is, how that equation will help us figure out what it is we need to know about the rate of formation of sun-like stars. And I'm also wondering how much advancement we'll make in that whole area as the years go on here.
Yes, so the Drake equation is a really lovely thing created by an astronomer called Frank Drake in the late 1960s. He was about to convene the first meeting of SETI, the search for what became called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And Carl Sagan was at that meeting. So was John Lilly, the dolphin expert, whose work we sort of tangentially mentioned when we were talking about trying to communicate with dolphins. And a number of other, leading scientists of the day. And Frank has a bit of a problem because he was thinking to set the scene. We need to have a rough figure for how many intelligent civilizations there might be out there that we could communicate with, because the idea of SETI was to point radio telescopes at nearby sun-like stars and see if there were anything being broadcast by them in terms of were there any signals being broadcast. So he came up with this thing, the Drake equation. It's just really a whole bunch of probabilities multiplied together to figure out the overall probability of there being life in our own galaxy. So you start with the rate of formation of sun-like stars, because obviously you need a sun-like star. Then then you try and figure out, well, how many of those sun-like stars would have Earth-like planets? How many of those Earth-like planets would develop life? How many of those planets that develop life would develop intelligent, communicable life? And that gives you a... and if you multi, and you also need, if you have a rate of formation at the start, the rate of formation of stars, so you now know the rate at which these communicable civilizations would be forming. So you need to multiply that by a time, and you need to obviously need to multiply by the length of time that an intelligent civilization broadcasts.
Right.
So you get a number, and the number will tell you the number of intelligent, communicable civilizations in the galaxy. So in the book, I kind of liken it to like a Dire Straits concert. So if you're in the dark at a Dire Straits concert and you want to know how many people, and you know they're singing that, you know, encore song, Money for Nothing, and you want to know how many lights, everyone puts their lighters on, don't they, when they play that slow
right.
song at the end of a concert, and you want to know how many lights Mark Knopfler can see at once. Well, of course, you need to know the rate at which people are entering the stadium, the number, the fraction of them that have lighters, and how long that they can keep a lighter on for. And that will tell you how many lights he can see at any one time. It's a bit of a, that's what the Drake equation is. It's just a way of, you say you have the rate of formation of stars, the fraction of those stars that will have an intelligent communicable civilization, and the length of time that civilization lasts for. So if you put in the numbers, obviously, we have a pretty good idea of what the rate of formation of stars is. We now know most that something like 10% of all sun-like stars, isn't this an incredible, I just can't believe this statistic, but something like 10% of sun-like stars in our galaxy have an Earth-like planet.
Ooh.
I mean, this is news. This is the information we got from the Kepler Space Telescope, obviously, which looked at thousands of stars in a very dense but distant portion of the galaxy and figured out that, yeah, you know, 10% of them have got a, you know, what looks to be a rocky planet in the at the right distance from the star to have water on its surface. That's not saying it will have water. It's just saying if water's on it, it could exist as liquid as it can on Earth. And we think that water's really, really crucial to life as
right.
we know it.
Right.
So, I mean, funny enough, hailing back to what the earlier caller said, you're obviously funneling down the numbers and just looking for humanoid life, because you're only looking for Earth-like planets. You're only looking for creatures that have radio telescopes. You're only you're really funneling it right down and looking for stuff just like you. It's the middle part of the equation. It's this crucial question. How common is life itself? If you have an Earth-like planet going around a sun-like star and it's got water on that planet, how many times out of 10, out of 100, out of a million, how many times will you get life forming? And this is a really, really fundamental question that we are getting closer to an answer, but we still really have no solid evidence either way.
Well, considering what's happening with science, I think it's not too far off. We're welcoming more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Ben Miller, the proud owner of a Wheaton Terrier. How about that? The author of a fascinating book, The Aliens Are Coming, The Extraordinary Science Behind Our Search for Life in the Universe. If you lived in Britain, you would know this man because he's all over. He's also a comedian and has been all over BBC television and radio doing comedy, and also is a highly acclaimed actor, filmmaker, and has done a number of documentaries as well. But he's a quantum physicist, so this is another area of deep interest. He's also the author of It's Not Rocket Science and host of the TV show of the same name. He's done lots of documentaries on temperature, the history of particle physics, and He's with us this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're sending our own messages, nothing new. We're just repeating some of what was on Voyager 1, which is now interstellar space. And these were some of the greetings from all over this planet.
Bonjour tout le monde.
Shalom.
Hola y saludos a todos.
Selamat malam hadirin sekalian. Selamat berpisah dan sampai bertemu lagi di lain waktu.
Kaipacamatna pitapas maitapas rimapayast runasimit.
Audi Diano.
Ashuli. Namaskar. Bishe shanti hok.
And we have time, I could talk about this for hours and hours, but we have time for a couple more phone calls for Ben Miller, and let's go to Jeff in Madison next. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, it's nice to talk about aliens that we're not going to sweep up and deport to another planet, but I'm going to be the curmudgeon here
right.
for a moment, and sort of like the guy with swatting the fly, and your guest knows exactly what I'm talking about. And this is a really rough calculation I just made. If you take intelligent life on Earth to be, I took 100,000 years start of language, but you could probably do it much less. 100,000 years represents something like, 13 100,000ths of 1% of the life of the universe. 13 100,000ths of 1%. Now, I sometimes think we all think if we just crane our necks a little farther, we're going to see that big-eyed Spielberg creature craning his neck, you know, past the planet to look at us. Just the odds of intelligent life somewhere else intersecting with our tiny little blip, not even a blip, short than that, in the life of the universe, I really think Carl Sagan would take his billions and billions and put a decimal point in front of each of those things. Anyway, I love talking about it. It's refreshing to talk about something else.
Yeah, well, isn't it, though, Jeff?
I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the call. Ben?
Absolutely right, yes. I mean, what we are faced with, of course, is the most phenomenal timing problem. The likelihood... Now, personally speaking, I think, you know, I have no evidence for this, but it's my gut feeling, I believe but cannot prove, that life is common. You know, that single-celled life is common in the universe. There's not an enormous amount. There's nothing to prove that. But the only crumb of comfort is that life began on the planet Earth pretty much as soon as it possibly could have done. So when the Earth formed, it was being bombarded by asteroids in what's called the late heavy bombardment, the same shower of asteroids that left all the craters on the moon, but because we have tectonics on planet Earth, all those craters got smoothed away. That bombardment was the environment in which the first life emerged, and we believe it would have the best theory we have from U.S. astrobiologist Mike Russell is that it began in a certain kind of volcanic vent on the ocean floor, and this is where the environment we think the first life began. Mm. And it seems to have begun pretty much as soon as it could have done. So that suggests to me that single-celled life is common. But, of course, complex life, the kind of life that we represent, intelligent, technological, complex life, complex biological life, seems to have arisen on Earth only once, in one single event, and therefore appears to be rare. Mm. So, if we have a situation where single-celled life is common, but complex, intelligent, communicable life is rare, mm-hmm. it's going to be a long way away.
Mm. Ben, We need to say goodbye to you.
Oh.
I know. This is so much fun. Well, please join us again sometime, won't you?
I would love to.
It was wonderful.
It's a fascinating subject. We haven't even scratched the surface.
I know.
Really.
Well, it's a pretty big topic. It's understandable. Would you please send a picture? Can you, Sadie, be in touch with Ben so we can get a picture of yourself, Clotted Wheaton, and I'll send you my old.
Oh, I would
so
love
we'll
to.
So we'll post
that.
It on our Facebook page.
She's just been groomed. So her hair's rather
perfect.
Short.
Perfect. Thank you.
She's looking good. So
good. Thanks.
Now.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you so much. The book is The Aliens Are Coming. Ben Miller, The Extraordinary Science Behind Our Search for Life in the Universe. We're going out with something else that was on that Voyager 1. It's out in space now. We're just giving you a second dose of Chuck Berry. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and to Scotty Myers for putting this great show together. Had a good time.